Hello and welcome to the next edition of the Jerusalem Post podcast. This is Gil Hoffman, Chief Political Correspondent Analyst of the Jerusalem Post. Today I'm going to be talking about the elections in what is the first in a series on the subject. This is Israel's fourth election in the last 2 years and the second election being held in the shadow of the novel coronavirus. Today I, together with the head of the Israel Democracy Institute, Yochanan Plesner, are going to help shed some light on what is expected to be the same this election and what might change. Then we're in for a special treat. The post-diplomatic correspondent Lahav Harkov will interview the chairman of the New Hope Party, Gideon Saar. Here is my conversation with Yochanan.
Hello and welcome to the Jerusalem Post Israel Democracy Institute podcast. I'm Gil Hoffman, here with the president of the Israel Democracy Institute, former member of Knesset Yochanan Plesner. Thank you for being with us here today.
Hello, Gil, and thanks for having me.
We are here at an exciting time in the election with just a little bit more than a month to go. Have there been any surprises in the election that you can note for our people who are watching and listening to this?
Well, one would expect that the answer would be negative. 2 years into a political crisis, a political and constitutional deadlock, and 1 year into the COVID crisis and heading towards a fourth consecutive election campaign, one would imagine that we would be dealing with the same actors and going through the same drill all over again. But actually, the fourth election cycle is nothing like the first three. In the first three, we had two major blocks, one the right wing plus ultra-Orthodox, led by a solid Likud party, and the other bloc, center-left plus the Arab party, led by a large blue and white party. And for the first time in a decade, a candidate that was almost on par with Mr. Netanyahu in terms of fit for premiership, i.e., Mr. Gantz. Well, all of that collapsed. It's no longer the case. We have a Likud party with around 30 seats, but the entire arrangement of the blocks has disintegrated in a way that redefines what it means to be right, left, and center. Blue and white fell apart. Gantz's leadership in the eyes of the Israeli public to some extent no longer exists, and it's even difficult to say who is challenging Mr. Netanyahu, whether it's Gideon Saar from the right, a former Likud member, whether it's Naftali Bennett, from the farther right, or whether it's Yair Lapid from the center. All three, if you ask me, if you now inform me, Gil, if you come back from the future and you inform me, well, post March 2021, someone else formed the government who is not Mr. Netanyahu, I would guess that it's one of those three, but it would be very difficult for me to determine who of them. So it's a very different election. Again, the only remaining stagnant feature is that the main question that is guiding it is who supports and who is against Mr. Netanyahu. And it's not surprising because in many ways Netanyahu is defining Israel's...
Let me ask you about that. Is this election really yet another to Bibi or not to Bibi election? Or are there issues that are deeper than that? Have we in Israel become so shallow that it's really all about one man? Or is there anything else that this election
Well, no, it's not so shallow because it's about one man and what he represents and where he wants to take the country. So it's quite clear, Gil, in one outcome or political scenario that is quite likely is that Mr. Netanyahu will achieve at least 61 seats, which is an absolute majority, alongside with his partners, the ultra-Orthodox parties, the extreme right, the radical right, plus Bennett. This group of allies might achieve a 61 majority, and then that would not only lead to a government led by Mr. Netanyahu, and there's an entire program that is associated with his bloc. Mr. Bezalel Smotrich, the leader of the radical right-wing party, just presented this platform. It includes stripping off the Supreme Court of its entire power, both to conduct a judicial review over Knesset legislation, over government decisions, politicizing this appointment of judges, politicizing the appointment of both the attorney general and legal advisors of ministries, basically crushing the rule of law and the principle of separation of power in Israel as we know it, and changing the nature of our democratic regime. So it's not only about a person, it's about a person and about the kind of agenda that he represents, largely given this agenda is driven by Mr. Netanyahu's own personal and legal woes, and it overlaps with ideological desire of extreme elements in the Israeli right, i.e. Bezalel Smotrich, and among Israel's ultra-Orthodox parties, who have a long history with the institutions of rule of law and Israel's Supreme Court.
So, Yochanan, your think and do tank, the Israel Democracy Institute, is all about empowering and educating the people to make them make smart decisions when they vote. But in the end, your building is right down the street from the president's residence. Doesn't he end up making the final decision about who ends up being our prime minister? And in this election, is that more true than in other elections?
Well, historically, the political role of the president in assembling new governments was symbolic. I mean, we knew generally after the election ended who has the highest chance of forming a coalition government, and the president assigned the mandate an important gesture. Given the complexities of Israel's political system, the fact that, you know, today Netanyahu is challenged by a few medium-sized parties, and all sorts of scenarios might become might emerge. The president, in some instances, the president's role might become more than just symbolic. But I think what will matter most is who will be able to negotiate his way post the elections to achieve at least 61 recommendations to form the next government. It might be Mr. Netanyahu with the ultra-Orthodox plus right-wing parties. Again, it's very unlikely that he will achieve that position without having Mr. Bennett support him. It might be a combination of, as I said before, medium-sized parties from the right, left, and center, that the main common denominator that brings them together would be the desire to end Mr. Netanyahu's rule. But from a substantive perspective, the common thread of such a non-Netanyahu government would be the need to overcome the COVID crisis, and not only from a health perspective, but primarily from an economic perspective. And this would actually make it easier to form such an incoherent, from an ideological perspective, an incoherent government, because the main agenda item for any new government would be initiating new reforms, dealing with the economic crisis, putting back hundreds of thousands of Israelis into work. And in this respect, the differences between the right, left, and center are not that great. The second agenda item of such a government, should it be assembled, would be, in a very broad manner, bringing Israelis back together, changing the rhetoric of incitement, the rhetoric that is based on searching for enemies from within and for traitors and so on, which is unfortunately characterizes much of the political discourse today and trying to identify a broader common denominator. And this might be manifested also in trying to legislate with a broad consensus some laws that will define constitutional arrangements that will define the rules of the game and the relationship between the different branches of government. So such a government might be unstable, but has enough substance that it can agree on that given the right motivation and the right political skill, it can also be quite a successful government.
So you can see the right-wing Yamina and New Hope parties working together with Meretz and Labor, if they both cross the electoral threshold, together with Lieberman's party and Yesh Atid there, all together with having the basis of not only deposing Netanyahu, but healing the country from the coronavirus and from society's ills.
Yeah, absolutely. This is for sure. It's an option. If those parties, this combination of, I would say, Zionist parties short of the Likud and the ultra-Orthodox parties, if they achieve more than 61, I think it would change the entire dynamic in a way that would also change the calculus of the ultra-Orthodox parties who have very little appreciation for serving in the opposition. And therefore, if there will be an option, if they won't, if the Netanyahu plus ultra-Orthodox combination will not have 61, I see very much an option of the ultra-Orthodox parties breaking up the alliances with Mr. Netanyahu and wanting to join the other form of coalition. I think that the most important, the most interesting scenario might be if both combinations achieve more than 61. Obviously, both of them include Mr. Bennett. So either Netanyahu plus ultra-Orthodox have 61 and above, or those medium-sized Zionist parties without the Likud and ultra-Orthodox also have 61. And in this case, Mr. Bennett will have to sit in his home in Ra'anana and decide which government does he want to lend his political power to help form and create, which direction the country will go, and who, and he will literally decide who will lead the country. And knowing Bennett for quite a few years, I think that if that would be the situation, he will try to leverage into he himself being the prime minister, even if he will have very few seats, even if he has a single digit outcome in the election, assuming that he will be the marginal, have the marginal vote and the marginal decision making capacity. I wouldn't exclude the option of seeing at least Bennett going first in a rotation government, which again would be extremely unprecedented to see sort of a leader of a small party become a prime minister as a result of that very skewed 2-year process that was very much centered around Mr. Netanyahu and his attempts to maneuver himself out of the legal process that he was caught in.
Well, that would definitely be a fascinating scenario. I can take you back to 2012 when Naftali Bennett and Yair Lapid were both entering politics, and I was spending time with both of them, getting to know them. And at one point, Naftali Bennett says to me, "You've met Lapid? What kind of guy is he? Can I have his phone number?" And so who knew back then that that could lead to the basis for a rotation in the prime minister's office in the future? I guess my last question to you would be about the role of Israeli Arabs, because Netanyahu has tried to bring them to the forefront. He's not running against them like he has in the past. He pretends at least to be running with them. You had a 64% Arab turnout in the last election, which was a record. This election, the Arabs are much more divided, split up their joint list. What will end up being the impact on Israeli democracy?
Well, it's a huge question. This election will very much be determined not by persuasion of different parties for voters to vote for them, but rather more about, it's a question of turnout. Who will come out of vote, especially during a COVID crisis? We didn't have an election under COVID with such high levels of unemployment. And all of the, in the turnout will also determine which parties will not cross at the threshold, and that will can completely tilt the relationship between the political blocks. There are four parties in the center-left block that are at risk of not crossing the threshold, and only one party in the right. So any kind of developments in that front might very much work in favor of Mr. Netanyahu's interests. Now, specifically with the Arab parties, the issue of the question marks around turnout are dramatic implications. If in the current Knesset, the joint list has 15 seats, based on about 65% turnout, a drop towards, say, a 45% turnout, and perhaps if one of the two lists representing the Arab minority will not cross the threshold, this representation can be cut to as low as 7 seats. This is 7 seats less for the center-left bloc, and might dramatically increase Mr. Netanyahu's odds of achieving the much desired 61 and above finish line. So the kind of dynamics, motivation, developments that will evolve over the upcoming weeks in the Arab sector will very much have an important role in determining what the overall outcome of the election will be.
Yochanan Plesner, President of the Israel Democracy Institute, thank you for being with us here on the Jerusalem Post Israel Democracy Institute podcast.
That's great. Thanks, Gil, for hosting me.
Pleasure. Ladies and gentlemen, I've been Gil Hoffman, Chief Political Correspondent Analyst of the Jerusalem Post. Thank you for being with us.
Gideon Saar, a 54-year-old lawyer, and a team of former Likudniks have set out to attack the politically formidable Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu from the rear. Let's hear what he has to say.
I'm Lav Harkov, senior diplomatic correspondent and senior contributing editor to the Jerusalem Post. I welcome you to an evening with New Hope leader Gideon Saar, sponsored by the Jerusalem Post and the Tel Aviv International Salon. Gideon Saar founded a new party, New Hope, that's running in this election. He is a former Minister of Interior and of Education, has held several other senior government positions, and he's going to say a few words about himself and his party before we go on to questions and answers.
Thank you, Lav. I prefer always to speak on the party or on the country rather than speaking about myself. New Hope is a new party, as you mentioned, with an aim to make change in this country. It is center-right party that puts the country before the politicians, which is very rare these days, by the way. We want to change the government. We want to replace the current government, but we also want to change fundamental things in this country. Electoral reform, term limit, significant changes on the education, internal security, economy. And so we need basically, or we are fighting basically for doing three things: to change, to establish, I would say, a stable government after 4 election campaigns in 2 years, and to avoid 5th elections. I believe that I can do it. I believe that only I can do it. I believe that if Netanyahu will win again, we won't be in a different place 1 year from now. We might be in another elections. It doesn't matter really how we will put the chairs around Netanyahu. It will bring us to the same situation. Bennett is not committed to make change. He made it clear he might go with Netanyahu. And Lapid simply cannot do it because he's coming from left to the center, which the vast majority of the public and the political system is simply not there. So this is how I see our task in these elections. We are working very hard. We are a new party, so we established our own organization, financial list, campaign, everything, and it is very challenging to do it for the first time. But I think that we already understand it's a significant party with a lot of people back this party, and with thousands of volunteers all around the country, and I'm very optimistic.
All right, let's open up with the politics. So that's what you closed with, and then we'll move on to the policies. So you come from the Likud. You were a member of Likud for decades, and a Knesset member and a minister, and many of the people in your party also come from Likud. What is the difference between your party and Likud, other than the person standing at the head?
It's a totally different issue. I served the Likud for seven Knessets. I was cabinet secretary of two Likud governments. I was a minister in two governments in the most significant portfolios, education and interior. But what happened now, it is an earthquake as I see it. Clear to me that today, and it was not like that 10 years ago or even 5 years ago, but today it is clear that Netanyahu is working for his own personal interests and not for the country. When he decided, in the midst of the most severe economic crisis we knew, to avoid approving the new budget, not to promote the necessary reforms for the recovery of the economy, for the renew of growth, and send us again to a new electoral campaign, as I said, for the fourth time in 2 years, it demonstrates something which I cannot live with. And it is to prefer your own interests. He wanted to break an agreement he signed, and in order to do it, he deteriorated the country to new election campaign. Of course, it's only it's the most severe example mm-hmm. I can give for this behavior, but as I see it, he's totally there. And therefore, it's not an issue of the old ideological arguments, because I cannot see someone who is in cold blood doing what he did as someone from the national camp, as someone who prefers the good of the country. And that brought me to the understanding I'm must quit from the Likud, I must establish my new party to be faithful to the values and the path I believe in, more than to the old framework that represents today totally different things. Likud means to add together people, sometimes from totally different opinions. Today, Likud is not representing anymore this thing, but to divide. So for me, it's not the name of the party that stayed as in the past, but the substance, which is totally different. And therefore, I thought I must break this equation that the right wing must be with Netanyahu, whatever he will do, and the left wing is his opposition. I broke this equation, and I built a center-right party faithful to path and principles and values and not to Netanyahu. And our aim is to replace Netanyahu, because I don't think he represents anymore my values and my principles.
As the leader of a center-right wing party, how far would you go in order to have a coalition without Netanyahu? Which parties, you know, where is your red line as far as a government that might be too left-wing? Is it Labor? Is it Meretz?
I'm not building coalitions today, and it is not reasonable 5 weeks before election day. We don't know the results to play with this coalition game. I have a task today to convince the public why we need change and why I'm the one that can do it. And this is what I'm doing today. But I can tell you that I would say anyone who accepts the basic principle of Israel as a Jewish and democratic state, I will invite for talks. I can think that some of the options are more or less reasonable to agree with me on the principles, but I think this is not only possible today, but it is even necessary, because what the next government will deal with is mainly not the old ideological divisions. I don't think that we are before a decision on a Palestinian state, which I opposed. I don't think we are before this kind of decisions. I think that the most important things in the next years will be economy, how to build again our economy, which is in a very bad situation after the corona crisis, and mainly how to build important systems like health system, health and education system. Mm-hmm. And this is the kind of issues which you can more easily understand, reach understandings with political rivals than other issues. Of course, we might have differences. It is possible that we will not agree. I will stay strong on my principles and on my views, but I think that today it is important to try to bridge over gaps. And by the way, Netanyahu is speaking a lot about a total right-wing government, but he always said from with leftist parties. Today he's sitting with Blue and White and with Labor. He sat with Tzipi Livni. He sat with Lapid. He sat, I believe, with almost anyone from the center-left bloc. So here is what for me is important, is of course to stand strong on my principles when I'm building this coalition, but to be committed to the idea we need a change here.
So you talk a lot about being sort of a unity candidate, that you want to bring together people from different parts of society, different political views, to be a change in leadership. But you hired strategists from the U.S., which is of course fairly common practice in Israel, but the strategists you've hired are associated with the Lincoln Project, which is this sort of right-wing anti-Trump outlet, just so our listeners know, that was really associated with mudslinging more than anything else, sort of very nasty political ads. On top of that, there are accusations of mishandling money, corruption, you know, which Prime Minister Netanyahu was also accused of and you're opposed to. So I'd like to hear, I guess, sort of what were you thinking when you were hiring them, and how are you moving forward?
We are tested on what we are doing in this campaign. We didn't make any nasty ads. We were very positive on our campaign, and we are tested. I'm responsible for what I say and for what we are doing, and we were very positive. These consultants worked with George Bush Jr. in the past and Mitt Romney and other candidates. I don't judge who they worked for in this business. You consult with different people, and you are free to accept or not to accept different ideas. They are consultants. So I don't see any problem with that.
So amid the accusations of mishandling money and also you know, sort of covering up for sexual harassment by a different strategist who worked with them.
We didn't work with this person, and we don't know him, and we are not connected to these things, and I'm not a judge, and we are not judged by these things. Right now, we are not working with them for the currently, mm-hmm. But it is not connected to this kind of accusations. It is from a totally different reason, but we didn't work with this person. We are not responsible for anything. It is even funny to discuss.
I don't know if funny is the word I would use, but moving on to that.
It is strange to, in this way, to transfer things through continents and people.
All right. Well, so let's bring things to the here and the now. Okay. I think the biggest concern these days for people who live in Israel is, of course, coronavirus. And while we have a world-leading vaccination campaign, we also are, you know, have a very high number of infections. Schools are opening, closing, opening again. What is New Hope's plan? If you become prime minister, what will you do to fix things fast?
You're talking about the coronavirus, or you're talking about the economy? Because it is two different things.
Yes.
About the coronavirus crisis. This government worked and working very bad. They failed. They failed in all important issues. They failed on enforcement. They failed on education. They failed on protecting businesses. They failed on a huge, huge path they built for importing the coronavirus from abroad by not checking people that enter to our airport, and by isolate them effectively after entering. So what I would do, I would take some principles that they didn't use. First of all, even today, they don't use differential approach. Why we are not opening schools in a totally green cities? There are cities with two people who are with the virus, but still all the students, and now maybe only 6 grades from 12, but still the others are in home, and there is no reason for that. So there is no, they spoke a lot of times about differential approach, but they never implemented that. Secondly, the easiest way is to work with, I would say, this primitive approach of closure and collective measures. But we have other tools. I'm speaking for months already about mass checking of population, which can much easier find out people who are ill, even if they are not symptomatic. And this is a very quick and cheaper way how to confront the coronavirus. We didn't use it. Today, we have this vaccination process. But still, when we open schools, we can check all the students in school, for example, once a week. And this is how we will know in due time that the children who are more than others and not symptomatic, but they spread the virus, we will know to identify them and to quickly deal with the situation. And we are not doing it. So it is logical for me that we will fail time again with the current approach. So I would say the government, they deal with it 1 year, but they didn't improve what they are doing in any way.
Well, so you talked about the need for a differential approach. I think one of the obstacles to a differential approach has been the makeup of the coalition, that the Haredi parties are concerned that, especially their cities are going to be closed more than others. You two have a good relationship with the Haredi public and the Haredi parties. Would you be able to stand up to that kind of pressure?
I have good relations with them. I have good relations with all the parties. But I don't work for them. I work for the country and for the public. When I was Minister of Education, and I had reports of ultra-Orthodox schools that are not working with the curriculum according to the demands they should follow, I cut their budgets in a very serious way. Even though they were in the coalition, they attacked me, but I prefer the general interest. I think it is very important to be fair. I want to be fair with everyone, but it is very important, for example, in this situation, to equally enforce the law. When you don't do that, you are losing the respect of the people, and less people obey the restrictions. So if I will be elected and I will be the prime minister, I will enforce the law equally in that respect and in other respects.
So back to coronavirus, of course, the other impact, which we briefly touched on, is on businesses, is on people's livelihood and ability to work. What do you think the government or a government that you would be in should do moving forward to, you know, lower unemployment and help the businesses that are collapsing?
I would say a couple of things. First of all, I would nominate a professional finance minister. I think that today, in the situation of the Israeli economy, we need to take out this job from the coalition trade talks and agree on a professional person that can do the job, and with the credit from the public, he has only one objective, and this is the Israeli economy and not any political objective. So this is one thing very important. Secondly, I would approve very quickly the budget and the reforms. It is very important to not only to approve a budget, but to approve economic plan. It is a scandal. We know every crisis is also an opportunity for changes, for reforms. But until now, we missed this opportunity. I'm looking at Netanyahu, who was the finance minister at 2003. And I was at the time the chairman of the coalition, and I promoted and implemented in the Knesset his economic plan at the time. It was very ambitious. It was very risky politically. We suffered from it afterwards in the 2006 elections. But I was sure, even if we can argue about one thing or another, that his interest is the good of the country. But I believe that Netanyahu of 2003, if he would have looked on Netanyahu of 2020, he will not believe that in a most severe crisis, he is not doing the basic things which we need to do for our economy.
What are those basic things? What needs to be done?
I would say we need to reform. We need a permanent headquarter against bureaucracy in the Prime Minister office. It is very essential today for reducing the cost of the living, for the growth, for a lot of reasons. We need to improve our civil service. We have an opportunity now to digitalize all the government, like a country like Estonia did. And they were able, a small country that only three decades ago released itself from the communism, they transfer the country to work with one digital card. You don't have to go for government offices. You don't need paper. You don't need to lose a day in work. You are just doing everything in the net. And I think that this country, the startup nation, surely can do it. And we had an opportunity right now. This government also neglected the issue of creating jobs, of moving forward with infrastructure works that can change requests in the markets, and to transfer people in terms of profession to do things that we will need to do, but 1 year is lost already. So I can elaborate more and more, but basically is, and of course, to change the approach for the business sector to help small businesses. It is extremely important. And by the way, less bureaucracy and less regulation is the most effective way. But also, if I can give one example, we can do, instead of giving every family money, to take the same amount of money and to give it to the public and to say you must use it in a voucher in one of the businesses that was hit by the corona crisis. And the tax authority, they have all the information. They know who are these businesses they compensate. So they can say, okay, take this money and use it. And in this way, you are giving help for those who really suffered. This is a policy. All the current plans I hear in the news today are fake. I think it's a show for the elections. I think if the government really wanted to do something, they would have approved the budget and the arrangements law with it.
So I want to move on to sort of geopolitical and security issues. Let's start with the new president of the U.S., Joe Biden. He has not called Netanyahu yet. Whether this is a big deal or not is a matter of dispute, but what I think is not in dispute is that Netanyahu does not have as good a relationship with the Democrats as he does with the Republicans these days. If you were to become prime minister, what would you do to sort of repair the bipartisan relationship with the U.S.?
I think, first of all, I will come with no negative sentiments from the past. And I can stand on our national interests without these sentiments that many and the Biden administration are feeling. It is a fact. Second, I think, as you said, it is crucial to restore bipartisan approach to work with Republicans and Democrats alike, also to work with all the segments of American society. And this is what I intend to do. We have in our list a very talented and useful guy, Danny Dayan, who was the counsel in New York, and he also shared the same approach and also connections with so many from the Democratic Party. And we will work fairly in order to restore this principle.
So there's major differences between the Israeli approach that a broad swath of the political spectrum supports and Biden's approach to Iran, you know, that they seek to return to the Iran deal. And it seems that some kind of collision is inevitable. How would you handle this?
Handle what, sorry?
It seems like some kind of collision dispute is inevitable on the Iran front. How would you handle it?
I'm not sure.
Okay.
We have a common objective. Mm-hmm. And the objective is that Iran will not get nuclear. It is, by the way, not only a consensus in Israel, not only a consensus between U.S. and Israel. It also become a regional consensus in the Middle East. Because if not, it is clear we will have a nuclear race in the Middle East. And this is, of course, something very dangerous. So we have a common objective. And even Netanyahu at the time said, fix it or nix it. which means potentially you can reach an agreement that serves our national interests, American interests. So the most important thing today is to come to an honest, discreet, and effective dialogue with the new administration headed by President Biden. Of course, as a sovereign country, we are free to protect our security and to protect our people. There is no doubt. We did it two times in the past, with regard to Iraq in 1981, with regard to Syria in 2008, I believe. But I think it is very important to try to reach understandings that serves our national interests. And I don't exclude it is possible just from the fact that also the United States saw during the time that passed from 2015 when the JCPOA was signed that Iran is breaching the deal. Iran is breaching when they are with the issue of the enrichment. Iran is threatening inspectors to throw them, even though they are not really inspecting. I'm not speaking about other issues like the missiles project and the way they are acting in the region, sponsoring terrorism and so on and so forth. But I believe I can promote an effective and sincere dialogue with the American administration and try to reach an understanding.
On the Palestinian issue, you are firmly opposed to a two-state solution, but what are you for? What can Israel do to improve the situation or mitigate the conflict with the Palestinians?
I think realistically that the U.S. also understand today that we are not in front of a final status agreement. Mr. Abbas is not, and the PA is not for a final status agreement. And we must find a practical and pragmatic approach about the thing we can do. And basically, we need to understand that the most reasonable thing is an autonomy where they can have much freedom as possible to handle their life with the minimum abilities to hurt our security. And there is also a regional issue which is combined because the arrangements that even if there will be not final status arrangements, but temporary arrangements, I believe must include Jordan and Egypt as neighboring countries, also to the territories we are speaking about, Judea and Samaria and the Gaza Strip. So I have a lot of ideas what we can do in terms of things like how we can improve life, daily life of the Palestinians, not in the way that can hurt our economy. How can we, what is our important interest that we want to protect? What are the things that we can improve their life? I think in certain aspects we can have a trilateral agreements in environment, economic, tourism. I think we can have a Jordanian-Palestinian-Israeli cooperation, for example. But I don't think when I'm looking at the Palestinian political system, we know how they educate their people. We know how they paying salaries to terrorists. We know they are not intending and they don't want to end this conflict with us. It is unfortunate, but this is the situation. I guess it will be in the foreseeable future. But we must find a way. And on the ground, there is a separation because due to the Oslo agreements and the disengagement from Gaza, the PA on on their territories, and Hamas in Gaza Strip are controlling the vast majority of the Palestinians. So there is a de facto separation on the ground. They should continue to rule their life, and we must continue to preserve our security interests and also to protect other national interests and also to protect our communities in Judea and Samaria.
So speaking of Judea and Samaria, we have these agreements with the United Arab Emirates and other countries, but especially with the UAE, Israel agreed to suspend any moves towards extending sovereignty. On the general issue of construction in Judea and Samaria, the Biden administration also, or Biden himself, is known to be a very strong opponent. How do you think that Israel should approach the issue of even just natural growth in these towns in the coming years?
Okay, two separate issues. One, the issue of sovereignty. First of all, I think sovereignty on our communities in Judea and Samaria, that today we have there about almost 500,000 of our citizens. It must be our objective also in the future, because I believe that Israeli citizens must live under the Israeli law. Netanyahu committed himself in this context you mentioned to suspend the issue of implementing sovereignty for a few years. As a prime minister, I will respect this commitment given to the Trump administration, which was a very friendly administration. Mm-hmm. And I don't think we can open this issue practically during the coming years. But I would say it continued to be our objective, and we will have to deal with two or three things we need to promote with regard to our communities in Judea and Samaria. Building, of course, it's a totally different issue. We must stand on the principle that people are living there. We cannot freeze their life. We need to build. We need to. They have their, as you said, natural growth, and we cannot stop life anywhere. And of course, there might be differences, but I think with almost all the American administration since 1967, we had disagreements with regard to the issue of the settlements. But I always believed, and I hadn't changed my mind, of course, that we have the right to live everywhere in our land. And I was always a friend of the communities in Judea and Samaria, and I will continue to be.
All right. I'm going to ask you some questions from some of the people who are watching us now. Got a list here. It'll start with a question from Daniel Elbogen about what are your policies for the environment in Israel?
Well, this question specifically I won't answer. We have a plan. We have a very serious plan, but we will reveal it we finished working on it, but we intend to reveal it. So what I will recommend, Daniel, is to follow our Facebook page, because it will be in the next days, maybe even this week.
Okay. Lior Sinai asked about your stance on religion and state issues, and sort of who has control over determining sort of who is a Jew in Israel, who's recognized as a Jew in Israel.
First of all, I'm against religion coercion. Mm-hmm. And I believe I'm against any coercion, including religious coercion, because altogether, for me, as a traditional Jew, as someone who cares about Jewish identity very much, it is important not to build walls between the Judaism and certain segments, big segments of our society. And this is what feelings of coercion creates. So this is very important. There are a lot of issues. You spoke about state and religion, generally speaking. But I believe that local communities, according to the nature of the community, can have the decisions how life will be there, and the most basic elements of that issue. And of course, there are general principles that we must practice. For example, if we are speaking about trade in Shabbat, on one hand, we cannot close everything according to a religious approach. People need to buy things, and I think there is a consensus that some of it must be open. So for the local authorities, it is to define what are the standards, what are the criteria, how to do it. And of course, on the other hand, we don't want the Shabbat to be as any other day in terms of how we look at the street. Like Sunday in Europe, it's, if you are in the street, businesses are not open like in any other day. So there are general principles. We must give freedom to local authorities, and local authorities will deal differently with it according to their different populations. And I think we also must make an effort to do what previously people like Professor Gabizon, late Professor Gabizon, mm-hmm. and Rabbi Maidan did, trying to find a common ground for the next decades. It is a very ambitious task. Some of the segments of our society will not participate in this effort, but it is very important that we will try to find a way how we can live together, because we have so much more in common. And I believe that 90% of the population can agree on these principles.
I think a major issue on this topic of concern for many English-speaking Olim is the marriage issue, that you can only get married through an Orthodox rabbi connected to the rabbinate, the recognition of Jews who are recognized by as Jews by conservative and reform rabbis, but not necessarily by Orthodox rabbis. What do you think about sort of recognizing those other streams of Judaism?
Last thing is on the conversion is, mm-hmm. I think we will see very quickly a decision of the Supreme Court, as much as I understand. Mm-hmm. And we will deal and argue about it afterwards. Marriage thing is something we need to find a solution for. So many people, that myself, I married in the religious way, but I know that so many people, they prefer different ways. I respect that. And on one hand, a solution must be found by the state. On the other hand, we need to think how not to destroy all the structure of the status quo created by Ben-Gurion, even though it was not preserved but developed through the years. But it is, we must see how we can have a solution, but in a very reasonable way. The fact is that during these 73 years, nothing changed in that respect. So it is a very huge task. We in New Hope, we deals with it. We had one of the last Fridays, we had a discussion in our leadership about this issue. I cannot tell you that we already find a solution. We are looking at some options, but we will do it eventually. And I think we are really in the place and the potential to do it because we are very balanced. And I think when we will reach the conclusion, it maybe will we will have a practical answer to that issue.
Okay, well, I think a lot of people will be looking for that answer when it comes out.
The most important thing is to answer in a way you can implement, because we've heard so many promises on this issue from certain parties in the past, and none of them was able to implement. So what I feel as a responsible leader, I must find a way, but a way I can deliver also. Mm-hmm. It is not to release an answer that will be supported by a majority of your voters, but will not execute. I want something that I can deliver. And this is what we are working on these days.
So I think this is going to be our last question. We have from someone named Dov Fuchs, who asked about Israel's selling weapons to governments that are major violators of human rights. We have a recent example of this coup in Myanmar, and Israel has sold arms to Myanmar. How would you address that issue?
Well, I don't want to commit myself to an answer, because in order to do that, you need to check, first of all, what are exactly the violations, and you need to see what kind of arms you're selling, and without a concrete facts, it is not reasonable to commit yourself to a certain answer. We have also our national interests. Of course, we must consider these aspects, but it is different. I don't know what is the current situation on human rights in this country. I don't know what we are selling to them. So I don't want to commit myself to a certain answer.
All right. Well, I think we have time if you have sort of a final closing statement you want to make. And then...
Well, I want to, this is the camera. Okay, for the first time now, I will speak to the camera. You people understand we need the change. I believe all of you made Aliyah from a very strong ideological point. We are all, by the way, or immigrants or sons of immigrants. My father made Aliyah from Argentina. So... if we are not immigrants, we are second generation for immigrants. And we came to here to build a state that our forefathers dreamed, and we were able to do something great by building this state. But I believe that we can do much more if we will build mainly a public sector which is working differently on a professional base, for the good of the country, with good people like we have in New Hope. So if you don't believe we need change and things are going in the right direction, you might vote for Netanyahu. But if you think we need change in this country, I think we are the people and we are the party that can deliver it. So I hope that you will do the right thing 5 weeks from now. Vote for New Hope.
Thank you, everyone, for watching. Sponsored by the Jerusalem Post and the Tel Aviv International Salon. In the coming weeks, we'll also have interviews with Yamina leader Naftali Bennett and Labor leader Mirav Mikhaeli. Have a good night.
Thank you so much for joining us today. We'll be back soon with more news, politics, and stories about the land, people, and places of Israel. This has been Gil Hoffman. Make it a great day.